Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook. And I'm telling you, this author is a jack of all trades, and some things we can't tell because they're in the closet, but I'm just kidding with you, Mark. But I'm really excited to welcome the program. Author of Yes is the Answer and the Progressive Rock Tales, Mark Weingartner. Mark, thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me.
And we're excited to talk to you, especially with like some of the things you've worked with Ozzy Osbourne and the Grateful Dead. Tell us specifically some of that stuff, and then we'll get right to the book.
Oh, well, I was a producer on a documentary about Ozzy called God Bless Ozzy Osbourne that was on Showtime last year. First authorized documentary about Ozzy's life. We made it in conjunction with the family. Jack Osbourne was one of the producers, as was Sharon. And then I'm currently producing a movie about Bob Weir, co-founder of the Grateful Dead. And so that's what we're doing now.
Well, you'll be coming back in June to talk about that, because my wife is a huge fan of the Grateful Dead, and I might be able to get her on the line to ask questions, because she's a journalist herself, but she doesn't want to do it. She's too busy with the kids, but I would love to have her as a co-host, because she has the radio voice. It's funny, Mark. I first did my first ever radio interview, and I asked my friend, so what'd you think of my wife and I? Well, your wife sounds like she should be on the radio. You shouldn't, but you were good. It's like, thanks. That was a great.
You have a fine radio voice, friend.
Well, it's because it's trained. When you interview over 25 people a week, Mark, you're able to do it. So let's talk about Yes is the Answer and the Progressive Rock Tales. Why did you write the book? What was your It seems like you're a huge music fan.
Actually, the book is an anthology of 20 essays about progressive rock. I ended with the book, and I found all these different writers to write about the book. Basically, because I feel like prog rock is really not getting it due, I feel like every other genre has sort of come back and been revisited and sort of embraced by a younger generation. But prog rock, you know, it just doesn't get the respect. There's a lot of good reasons for that, especially because a lot of it was terrible and, you know, it was tended to be on the pretentious side and overblown and such. But at its best, it's really wonderful music. And there was like a period like in the early, from 69 to 74 or so, where there's some really perfect stuff made. So we just wanted to shed a light on that stuff and get people to those records out again.
Absolutely, it sounds like it. And you have to define for me progressive rock, because I don't really know the definition of it, and kind of give me some examples of it so I understand. I mean, I read some of the bio that was sent, but I'm still not understanding.
Progressive rock is sort of, it's almost exclusively a British export. It was made by mostly musicians that had been classically trained in conservatories, and then that they loved blues and other forms of rock, and they decided they didn't want to just come out and play three-chord rock. So they wedded their classical training to backbeat and electric guitars and, you know, rock and roll. And what came out of that was a sort of classically influenced rock. And so bands like Yes, Genesis, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, King Crimson, probably the most prominent of those bands.
Okay, I'm understanding it a little bit more. So specifically, you were in the process of the editing process of all these different writings about progressive rock.
Right.
So tell us
exactly, specifically
one of the stories, like parts of it, about how they kind of talked about their career and stuff. Is that how you did it, or how they wrote it, some of them?
Most of the writers, well, because of this is sort of because the golden prog rock era is sort of a bygone era, happened 35 years ago. Many of the writers in the book really talk about their childhoods and what progress meant to them when they were kids and how important it was to them. So what we have is a lot of first-person essays about people's experiences with Frog Rock, whether it's in regard to relationships or drugs or sexual experiences that they might have had while listening to this music or concerts they saw. All of our writers certainly have a soft spot in their heart for this music, and a lot of really funny and smart and interesting pieces in the book.
That, I think I find that interesting. So basically, most of the people that wrote this were fans of certain progressive rock bands, would you say?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Every piece is about a different band.
And what was your favorite piece?
There's a bunch of great pieces. We had Rick Moody, who's a novelist who wrote the book The Ice Storm that became that movie, The Ice Storm. And he wrote a really incredible piece about Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, sort of the first half of the piece sort of saying why they really are kind of terrible, and then the second half of the piece sort of defends them and talks about why they're important to them, which really speaks to the ambivalence. A lot of this music is about loving what you really intellectually understand as problems, you know what I mean, and sort of embracing it despite the problems, and it's sort of a lot of attention that goes into being a prog rock fan, because if you look at a band like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, I mean, incredibly, they were all very good musicians, and they knew it. They were big egomaniacs, incredibly self-indulgent music. They would play these 30, 40, 50-hour-long suites. They toured with a 70-piece orchestra, and it nearly bankrupted them. I mean, they were just so over the top. So it's like, you know, but they were huge people. I mean, they amazingly, there was a time when that kind of thing was top of the pops, you know. So, going into it as an adult thinking, well, a lot of this stuff is kind of ridiculous. But then you go back and you listen to the records and you're like, well, you know, there was a lot of, you know, a lot of beautiful music made, and there's some really wonderful stuff, so despite all of that. But sort of the tension of prog rock, as opposed to...
This sounds like this could be a documentary in itself. If you could take the writers and go into the, and then find different parts of it. Mark, I was in the professional wrestling business for over 9 years. So I know exactly, going from town to town in minor leagues, but still in that fat and fans following. So these people that wrote about these certain progressive rock bands would talk about their whole experience, going to the concert, listening to the concert, being able to feel the music. And if there was a woman that wrote, maybe she was a groupie in one of the bands or was in backstage and saw the groupies and saw the different things that took place. Like you said, the drugs and all
prog rock, I'm like, almost every other genre is such a male genre. Like, only boys really went to see these shows.
Oh, geez. So, no, that's not good.
Yeah, well, the groupies was not real. I mean, I'm sure there were groupies, but it wasn't like, you know, the Rolling Stones or something. It was like, this was about boys who were really into musicianship and really into the virtuosity of the musicians. They really got off on that. So it was really... You do have a couple of women in the book, however. But one of whom, we also have a few musicians like Peter Case, who's a singer-songwriter, writes a piece, and Nathan Larson, who was in a band in the 90s called Shudder to Think, writes about his experiences in that band. So we have some musicians, we've got some screenwriters, we've got the guy who wrote Ed Wood and People vs. Iris Flint, he writes about Todd Rundgren, we've got novelists, all kinds of stuff. It's a really neat book.
And do they talk about also going and traveling to these events and I guess in the process of just, you know, saving their money to go to the concerts? And I guess also hearing from different friends saying, why do you like this music? So there's probably a lot of arguing as well, saying, come on now.
A lot of defending, which is good because it needs to be defended. Because at the time, you have to understand that critics hated this music. which was always a critically lambasted genre. No one liked it. It's a very rare exception. Maybe when you go into Peter Gabriel's solo career, critics really like that stuff. But that was only after he left Genesis that he got the respect. So, you know, it needs to be defended. It needs to be championed. It needs to be held up to the light again and for people to understand, hey, there's a lot of great stuff here, you know.
So what would you say specifically was your favorite band of all time, progressive rock?
Oh, boy. Well, first show I ever saw as a kid was Yes. And it was in the round. They had a round rotating stage that slowly turned throughout the show. And they would win. The keyboardist Rick Wakeman wore this silver Mylar cape. They were like superheroes to me when I was a kid. They had like possessed magic powers, you know. They were like Justice League of America or something. So I was really taken with that band, and I still love that band. And then I liked this band, King Crimson, which was founded by this guitarist named Robert Fripp, and have gone into various mutations over the years. They were much more avant-garde, much darker, much more angular. Much noisier and stranger all the other prog bands. So I like that. And then Genesis, I love as well.
I find it very interesting because, again, it, definitely a British invasion in so many aspects. And at first, when the British invaded the United States a second time, I'd say the 70s and 80s, people first were embracing it. Then once kind of it went into changes into, I guess, heavy metal and things like that, people that...
Here's what happened. So the prog rock, like I said, was a totally British phenomenon. Massive, it gets really big. It starts selling out. Yes, it's playing stadiums. It's really huge. Punk rock completely destroyed it around 76, 77. Just when prog rock was getting really unbearable and just was kind of really going. That's when ELP was touring with the orchestra and it was getting ridiculous. And then along comes the Sex Pistols and all the other punk bands. And in England, that was a big cultural sea change, unlike in America. It was a big deal, and that just completely squashed. It certainly squashed the movement now. Of course, bands like Yes and Genesis endured, but their music changed. It became more pop-oriented. Genesis became a pop band, obviously.
Yes.
And enjoyed the biggest success. I mean, and they became massively successful. But they were no longer really a prog band, and Yes, change, you know, Owner of a Lonely Heart, that kind of stuff. That's pop music. So they had to adopt in order to survive, and those that adopted survived.
And Yes, I guess, is the only one. But you think they went pop as well, Yes?
Yes, post 77. And they started getting into like Owner of a Lonely Heart, you know, that kind of stuff in the 80s and the 90s when they were. They've become a very different kind of bands.
Because you're definitely dating me. I was born in 73, so I'm trying. So it's interesting me to give us this history of this mark and what happened in specific ways. And I think that people who want to pick up this book are going to love progressive rock. Other people are going to like it because they're rock. They love music, and music anthologists would say, "Yeah, I got to read this because this is a definite read for me to say, hey, I can learn more about progressive rock, understand things." I think even lots of universities are now teaching a lot of the history of rock music. So
yeah,
I think
yeah,
that. Well, go ahead.
even if you don't like the genre, you have cold writers. These aren't just rock critics. We have great novelists in this book. It's really a literary book. It's a literary anthology, so come for the great writing and then learn prog rock as a consequence of that, even if you're not a fan.
And I can see, and I think this is going to be fantastic for you, and I think that hopefully the success, and I know that you'll find all the prog rock band fans lining up for this book. I hope for you.
And hopefully
a show like this will bring it out. But I didn't know about progressive rock till you kind of educated me on this, Mark. So I appreciate that. And you see, I'm asking certain questions in ways saying, you know, because I can't wait till the book comes in to really check it out and say, oh, my gosh, I get it now, Mark. Because I remember specifically, you know, Genesis and Phil Collins. And I remember, yes, when you were talking about the songs. And I remember all these things. But come on now. Before then, what was it like? And I guess we're seeing that it could not last as like certain theme-based bands did, only alive. Are there any progressive rock bands still playing today that you could go and check?
There are bands. There's a band called Porcupine Tree. There's a band, I don't even know if they're still around, called Dream Academy. These are like these post-prog progressive bands that have forged careers on a much smaller scale. It's more of a cult thing.
Yes.
But then you hear strains of prog rock in certain contemporary rock and roll. It's just, if you listen to a band like Grizzly Bear, who's a big indie rock band, you can certainly hear elements of the Flaming Lips, the Oklahoma band. They certainly have elements. They're big Pink Floyd fans, so there's certainly elements of prog in their music. You hear it's just now slowly gaining acceptance among hipsters and cool bands as being something that they're not ashamed to say that they like. So you're seeing it in some mutated form.
All right, well, fantastic, Mark. Where can we purchase your book, learn more about you, and find out things?
It's on Amazon now. You can buy it on Amazon. It's also a Kindle book. The official publication date is May 14th, so it'll be in Barnes & Noble. So just pick up your prog and prog on, my friend.
And are you hoping this is going to be a big-time book that's going to do really well? What is your hope?
Well, one always hopes, but I'm guessing it's going to be a cult favorite, and that suits me fine.
As an artist, you're paying the bills and other things, so this is just your passion. So I wish
that's
you all the
exactly.
And I hope that you enjoy the book signings and getting to talk to the fans. And I think that's what you're truly wanting to do this for is your art. And I really commend artists for doing these types of things. Mark, do you have a website as well to find info?
We don't have a website up here. We have a Facebook page. Yes, is the answer on Facebook if you want to check it out. We've got some pictures up there. It's fun.
All right. Well, Mark, good luck to you. Going to have you back next month to talk about the Grateful Dead project. So I'm going to really enjoy that. And I'll keep in touch. So take care.
Thank you, sir.
All right, take care. Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Boy, oh boy, am I starting to feel better. And for my listeners out there, guess what? If you've been listening to a lot of the interviews, I have been sick again, the third time. I'm getting sick and tired of this. And it was funny, I went into the yesterday, and they said, this is the third time you've been here. You're spending a lot of time here. And I'm like, this has got to stop. So hopefully, Tosh, with the weather and everything, we're finally going to end all that. So I want to welcome the program author Tosh Berman, author of Sparkstastic. Tosh, thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Yes, and if I told you I had bronchitis, you'd say, "Wow, you're a trooper for sure." And I wonder what these people like Sean Hannity or the people that interview so many people, how they keep their voices going all the time. I need to have them on the show just to tell me that, so I can get.
Well,
go ahead.
They have doubles. You don't know that. There's people they hire that have exactly the same voice. And, you know, whatever they're saying, you know, maybe people are not listening out there, but it's all double. It's all trick. I hate to tell you that.
Well, and then I guess I'm a machine in certain ways. So let's talk about the book.
You're the real person. You're the real person. The others are fake.
So let's talk about specifically your background, and then we're going to get into Sparkstastic. And I think that the whole story of visiting London and following a band, that reminds me of my days as a professional wrestler. But let's go first specifically about your background.
Well, I'm a publisher. I have a press called Tam Tam Books that focuses on French literature, translated into English. And I was a book buyer for many years at Book Soup in Los Angeles.
Quite.
And
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. So you have been on both sides of the fence in certain ways, and I guess by being a journalist in this book, that took mm-hmm. another spot, because you're used to always publishing for people, not writing, right? Or did you do some writing too?
Exactly. I sold books, I bought books, I made books, I served books. I did everything except writing a book until very recently. So now I've done the full book, everything possible.
You've done the full gamut. So tell us specifically about this band Sparks. I've never heard of them, and maybe I'm wrong about this or not.
Well, Sparks is a band that's been around for at least 40 years. They're an American band. They're actually from Los Angeles. So some people think they're from Europe. Some people think they're from Russia. Some think they're from Japan. They're sort of a mysterious band in many ways, because very few people know about their lives or their background. But they've been around for 40 years. They've been on every major label in the world many times, even over. And they're still going very strong after 40 years.
So,
Go ahead.
I was going to say, so have they ever had a big hit, Sparks?
Yes. Actually, in London in the 70s, they had a huge hit called This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us. And then in the 80s, they had hits in America, like Cool Places, which was recorded with the Go-Go's, and another song. So they were very popular in Los Angeles during the early 80s. You used to be on a station called K-Rock. It was a very influential rock and roll station at the time.
Okay, so when you got the opportunity, Tosh, to travel with them, to go to London and do this, it must have been a huge honor, because you're a huge fan of them. This is like your band.
Yeah, well, to make a point, I do know them, but I did a totally separate project. I didn't actually tour with them or go with them. I went by myself. So, in other words, I had to raise the funds to go there, and I had to make arrangements to live in London. And I had to sort of disrupt my life and my working life to write this book and to spend time to see these series of shows. And what the book is about is Sparks at that time had 21 albums. And what they did in London is they did 21 shows each night focusing on one specific album from beginning to end.
Wow.
Every album. Even albums nobody cares about by them, they did a concert for it. So my book is really about me. It's more of a memoir than, say, like a band biography. It's more of a it's a memoir and a travel journal diary of me going to London to see all these shows and my emotional feelings and my financial dealings and the people I dealt with in London. And that's what the book is really about.
Understand completely. And so you decided this is not like you knew who they were, you're a fan of them, but this was more about you're doing this, you want to see the 21 shows. So you get to London. And what, again, being an American, what's the difference between London and the United States, especially LA? What would you say
we share a common language, and that's about it. I mean, the London mindset and the Los Angeles or American mindset is totally different. And that's sort of the shocking aspect of it. And I also spent some time in Paris before I went to London on this specific trip. And I make comparisons between Parisian citizens and London citizens as well as American citizens. And London is, London is an incredible city. I mean, it's this remarkable culture. And I write a lot about London culture and London cultural history, like in the 20th century history. But what I find fascinating about London is just the nature of the people and how they do things there and how they think about it. And at the time, London was actually quite a violent culture. I mean, their idea was violence on a daily basis, more than I find in Paris or even in Los Angeles.
Interesting. So let's go specifically in what reminds me of London. The only thing is the Olympics and how they had the opening ceremonies. Did that really tell a history of London, or you didn't think? Did you get to watch the opening ceremonies?
No, I did not. I did not. No, I didn't see that.
Oh, you didn't see
that? But what I did notice about London was a lot of CCTV cameras everywhere.
Okay.
Every time a citizen or a person walks out to London, like they go to a shopping place, you're photographed at least over 150 times.
Wow.
So I'm not sure it's because of the IRA bombings in the past, or, you know, this has been happening. Like,
way before 9/11, for instance, and the cities have been attacked over the decade. But there is like a high security, or at least you're being always being filmed somewhere on the streets, and I just find that fascinating.
Well, I find it fascinating as well, Tosh, that that they do have that. So I guess they have protection, but we know that there has been terrorist attacks in London as well. Mm-hmm. What else did you learn from the historical points of view, I guess, of the sightseeing of London?
Well, first of all, Ron Mayall, who's the main songwriter for Sparks, he has a very strong visual look, especially in the 70s. He used to have a mustache that looked like Charlie Chaplin. Or Hitler, depends on your point of view. And it's unusual for a pop star or a pop singer or a pop artist to have a mustache that looks like either like Charlie Chaplin or Hitler. And I write about his mustache a lot in the book, and specifically about Charlie Chaplin. And where Sparks did their shows in Islington, London, which is North London, many, many years ago, Charlie Chaplin did a series of live appearances for shows before he came to Hollywood. In that part of London as well. So I make comparisons between like Charlie Chaplin and Sparks and the appearance and the whole sort of cultural history of Charlie Chaplin as well as Sparks.
Do you go into any of the background of the fans of Sparks in London comparing them to United States fans of Sparks?
Yes. Well, actually, the show attracted not only English fans, but also fans from France, from Japan, from Germany, and Italy. A lot of people actually traveled to the show. There was very few American fans there at the time, and most of them who were not, if they're not English, they were from like from other parts of Europe or Japan. And I write about those people and why they were there and why would they be attracted to Sparks? Of course, to be a Sparks fan is like being a very small club, and I don't know these people, they don't know me, but we all share a same passion, which is for the band Sparks. And it's fascinating how all types of people come to these shows, usually not great groupings, but like maybe one or two from each, from part of the world. And it's a fascinating group of people. It's just we're all sort of devoted to this band, and the fact that we all have to sacrifice to go to London for a great period of time. The whole show talks about, I mean, it was 21 nights of shows, but the series of shows lasted from, it lasted about a month and a half. So I had to stay there for a month and a half, as well as other people who went to all the shows.
So people basically had to sacrifice their life in certain aspects, meaning they had to...
They had to stop their jobs,
yes,
or they
exactly,
not to work, or they're unemployed, or I don't know how. I mean, in London, the time was deadly expensive. I mean, I've been to Tokyo, I've been to Paris, I've been to other parts of the world, but London was, like, just outrageously expensive. Just to get, like, a chain store pizza and a glass of wine and some olives beside it cost me, like, $30 a night.
And what was the time period you were in London for that time?
May through June.
May through June.
Of 2008.
Oh, 2008, okay. So the Sparks band is getting long in the tooth as well, right? the band.
It's very interesting because the first shows was basically English guys with their sons. It seemed like they took their children with them to the show. And the kids were probably acting like, oh, my God, why is Dad taking me to this weirdo show, And then as the show progressed, especially during the Sparks were heavily into electronica music. They're one of the first electronica bands as well. And for number one song in Heaven, which is a very popular, very influential album in the electronica world, it seemed to be the whole club. It turned from like British fathers with their kids to all of a sudden a gay disco.
Oh, jeez.
It was like wall to wall, like gay disco, like Studio 56. It was incredible. This changeover from one album to the other. So the audiences were the age bracket was everybody from like in their 50s to like teenagers. Over the period of time in the shows.
And from this memoir, you're learning about yourself as well, taking this shot by leaving a month and a half from your job to do this.
Yeah.
And the sacrifice
you had. Yeah, it was difficult.
And I'm sure
difficult at times.
And family would probably were thinking, you're nuts, Tosh, to take a month and a half off to go follow a band.
Most people, when I told them I was going, said, you're insane, and two, you're crazy, and or you're a liar. You're not going to go. You're just lying. That was sort of the general response I got from the people around me when I told them I was going to go to these shows.
And I guess the people who would really enjoy this book are people, first of all, that like to learn about the history of London, people who love music, love the history of music, people who love people who take shots and chances and drop everything and move somewhere without thinking about it. And I guess the whole ultimate culture shock of London versus the United States and seeing the differences of people and I guess the fans. Everyone loves to follow fans.
The book is about Sparks, the band, and their music. But you're right. It's about all these other levels, about like going to London, about comparing English culture with the rest of the world. It's about the nature of being a fan of something or somebody. And also learning about the culture around that place, the location. I mean, pretty much like the stars are Sparks. London itself is a character in the book as well.
Well, Tosh, I hope you're able to, from your investment of the month and a half, have a great selling book that does very well so that you can make that you have a good rate of return on your investment of that month and a half. But I think it's something you're going to never forget for the rest of your life because of your fandom of Sparks and also your fandom of people. So I can tell you love watching people. So, Tosh, where can we find more information, purchase your book, and learn more about you?
Well, you can get the book. It's published by a Barnacle Book. It's distributed by PGW. And you can get the book at your local bookstore. If they don't have it, they can special order it or order it for you, and as well as getting it online and, on all the famous online bookshops that are out there.
Well, Tosh, I can't ask you to publish me when I write a book because of your genre of who you publish, but I will definitely stay in touch. And when you have another book out, because I have a feeling you're going to write another book. I have a feeling.
Yes, I will. I will for sure.
Because once you write one and you get it published, you're ready to roll for more of them. So I hope that I'll have you back when you have your next book out. But it was great, and I think our London audience will find this very fascinating. They should pick up the book, and also our United States fans and our fans all over the world. So take care, Tosh, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. You're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Bye-bye.
We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, and I'm really excited to have this author on the program. A lot of times the authors, but I think we have a lot in common. Maybe he's gone through the war a little bit more than I have because my girls are a little younger still. So I want to welcome to the program author Brian Clems. You're the author of Oh Boy, You're Having a Girl, A Dad's Survival Guide to Raising Daughters. Brian, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me, Neil.
Okay, so this is going to be so interesting because what made you want to write this book? I guess because three girls is a challenge, but I'm sure your background's going to help us specifically to know how much of the war you've been through.
Yes, I have three young daughters, 5 and a half, 4 years old, and almost two. She's going to turn two here in May. And I decided to write the book because when my first daughter was born, I was completely expecting to have a boy. I don't know if it had been built in my head since I was young, or I just imagined this mini version of me. And when she was born and came out, I could only think to myself, I have no idea what to do with girls. I had a sister, but I raised her more like a boy myself. So I kind of had it in my head, what am I going to do? And immediately I was surrounded by all this pink and all these kinds of other things and tea party accessories that people were giving us. And from there, I realized I was kind of out of my element. And over the course of a few years, I started to understand, the benefits and some of the terrifying events of raising daughters, and thought I would share everything I learned with any other dad who's going to go through this terrifying event.
You're doomed, Brian. I mean, honestly, come on now. And I think that I don't know if I always look at it in that way of having first three girls, and my girls are 8, 4 years old, and age 2, that you look at specific things and say to yourself, okay, I was expecting a boy. it helps me being a teacher and I guess being involved in a lot of those things, but I kind of don't go down to this level. This is one thing I've recognized, and I'm sure you've recognized in the book. Once your wife has a girl, you might as well forget about ever holding it. That basically she is, then the second one's when finally you kind of get that bond more, because the first is pretty much just everyone, because a girl gets doted over compared to a boy, in my opinion.
Oh, everyone. Everyone wants to get their hands on that little girl and dress that little girl. And so it kind of buys you a little time early on to kind of get your pairings together and understand what to do. And I should say, from the minute my oldest daughter, Ella, was born, I was madly in love with her. And I knew this was going to work somehow. I just wasn't quite clear how it was going to work. And so over time, as my second daughter was born and third, I just kind of developed a lot of those skills and started to understand, you know, how to assemble a proper tea party and how to properly be involved in that. And those are the kinds of things that, you know, worried me at first, but now I've grown to love.
So give us an example of assembling a tea party. I've never done that, but tell us about it.
Sure. In the book, I cover this, but I actually come down with the Ten Commandments of properly participating in a tea party. And a couple of examples of that are, one, you know, you drop whatever you are doing at the time when you receive that invite from your daughter to participate in that tea party. It's incredibly important to her that fake tea is ready to go, and you need to be ready to drink it at all times. Another one of the commandments is you drink every cup served to you, no matter how many there are and how long it lasts and how much you eventually have to shake tea because of all these cups. And another example would be you always, always engage your fellow guests at the tea party, whether they be real stuff or make-believe. And these kinds of tips will help allow you to endear yourself to your daughter and really create wonderful memories.
And that's so quite interesting. I find that fascinating in a lot of ways, that there has to be rules involved. And then if you don't have a tea party, it's the same thing playing in the kitchen, same thing playing restaurant. You have to have your full attention. If you're going to play with your kids, have your full attention on them. Don't decide when you're going to. You're going to be on your iPhone or you're going to fall asleep or different things. When you have that precious time, regardless of how much time, it's so important to have their full attention.
Oh, I completely agree. And I've actually been lucky in my life because I'm very much into games and playing no matter what it is. And I was nervous that these kinds of things wouldn't interest me as much. But what I basically learned as I grew as a dad of a daughter, or dad of daughters, is that I started to get the best of both worlds. I've already had my experiences growing up with certain sports and that kinds of things, and I'm still getting those with my daughters. But I'm also getting these new experiences of learning about color coordination and outfits and fashion shows and tea parties and other things like that and ballet. And so I feel like now I'm getting these whole new experiences that are really kind of fulfilling my life.
Oh, please tell me about the fashion shows now. I think that's going to be quite interesting as well. So you have a lot of dress-up clothes that they wear.
Oh, we have so many dress-up clothes everywhere. From the minute they were born, we had family members that wanted to buy them princess outfits and dress-up outfits. And then, thankfully, some of them gave us doctor's outfits, so we had a little variety. But all that matters is that I'm strong enough to lift the bin out of the closet that has all of them in. I open it up, and I sit in the room and announce them as they come through. And they love this, up until a point where they believe I need to be involved, and they start dressing me up. And I've always been nervous. I was always nervous that I'm going to forget about this and walk out the door dressed, you know, in a tiara and a big fluffy dress. But thankfully, that hasn't happened yet. Although if I did, I would do it with pride, knowing my daughters enjoyed it.
All right, we're talking to Brian Clemes, author of Oh Boy, You're Having a Girl, A Dad Survival Guide to Raising Daughters. And I think that this is going to be just volume one of this, Brian. I think you already know this, because the easiest, you're dealing with the easiest times with girls. When they're teenagers, you're going to, oh my, it's going to be quite interesting.
Oh, I'm completely terrified of the teenage years. I was recently speaking with another friend of mine who has teenagers, and he told me that, you know, the downside with the teenage years are they act like teenagers. He said the upside of the teenage years are they tend to get more argumentative with their mothers and come searching for comfort in their dad's arms. And he's like, that's the thing you really look for during those teenage years, while waiting through all the dating, which you forbid until she's 35, and everything else that goes along with that.
You got it. And let me talk about the reason is because, Brian, it's so important for our model to be such a great gentleman model, because you don't want them to have our bad qualities be the who they're dating. And that's the key component about why they come to us so much more as teenagers, is because they're looking to find a mate and they want to know what we're like. They could care less about us, and we're going to see that more and more, and I'm sure you're seeing it with your eldest daughter. Slowly but surely, she wants to be more around mom and not as much around you. Have you noticed that too? That's the other hard part about it as well. As little kids are more, you know, yeah, let's be around daddy, but now it's more about mommy. I want to be around mommy to see what mommy does. But then later on, it's going to be the complete difference.
Right, and I completely accept that. I've had the times when they're real little that they'll often come to me, and then for several years, especially my older two daughters who share a room, now always call for mom to take them to bed. I want to feel like it's because they love her so much, but I have also a feeling it's due to my terrible singing. But anyway, I hope that the things that I do and I can teach them, and by being a good dad and loving them and being involved in their lives and doing everything that they really want to do and trying to teach them the right way about how life should be and how things should be done will help them as they get older and they do start to do things like date and search for companionship. And hopefully, you know, the guys will have a tough time living up to my expectations through the girls' eyes, not just my eyes.
Absolutely. So let's continue with the book. Other types of survival guide. We don't want to give it all away, but I think that anyone that has daughters should get this book. Anyone, I guess, also that are grandparents that are dealing as their grandfather dealing with girls. But I think also moms will be interested as well to hear the point of view of what a dad would say about girls.
Yeah, I've actually had a lot of great feedback from moms out there. The book was really written for both parents, moms and dads, specifically for dads to relate, but also for moms to relate, like you said, about their husbands and say, now I know what my husband is going through. One of the kind of fun sections that I have in there is all about questions you never thought you'd be asked. And these go anywhere from, you know, dad, why did you sleep in the same bed as mom? So why don't you sleep with a baby doll? And those kinds of questions, I try to deliver, you know, what your gut tells you to say and why it's the wrong answer, and then what the right answer is to help get you either out of this situation without, you know, lying to your daughters, because ultimately, you know, I don't really believe in that.
So the feedback's been very good for the book so far? You've been pleased?
Oh, yeah, I've been really pleased. You know, people have been very supportive. I've got wonderful emails, you know, on social media. People have been reaching out to me and telling me things like, I loved your book. I can completely relate with how Dora is ruining our lives. Or not Dora, well, Dora too, but like Disney is kind of creeping its way into everything in our lives. And for mom too, that's like, you know, my husband absolutely has no idea how to dress my daughters. I'm glad you have this 17 list of things you should always do. You know, by way of matching things, not always dressing them in baseball jerseys, that kind of thing.
Oh, isn't it terrible the amount of clothes, Brian?
Oh my God, there are so many clothes. I have like a Homer Simpson wardrobe where all my shirts are very similar, all my pants are very similar, and you know, I kind of just pick them up, give them a little sniff test, make sure they're clean, and throw them on. Those my daughters. I try to put things on, and my wife gives me the you know, I'm disappointed in you guys because the shirt doesn't match the pants and the type of animal and the color. You know, even if they're both pink, they're different shades of pink, apparently. And, you know, usually I forget socks or don't put on the weather-appropriate clothing. And so I get a hard time from that. But I am getting better, and I think that's something that hopefully I can help other dads get better at, too.
Because so much clothes, there's so much laundry, right? And I'm sure you participate, and it seems like you're very involved, Dad, in a lot of the laundry as well, right?
Oh, yeah, I really help. My big chores on the laundry front are often carrying all the baskets. We have a two-story house, so you have to go all the way up and all the way down, carrying all the baskets of the clean clothes and the dirty clothes up and down, and kind of keeping my girls in order by making sure they get their clothes into the laundry baskets and the hamper to make their way down. So I do try to help out in every way that I can. My wife actually won't let me wash the actual clothes because she's afraid that I will shrink them and that I've learned I don't fold them properly. I guess there's a proper way to do this, and I'm still unclear on that, no matter how many times she shows me.
Well, you're very lucky if she puts the clothes away, because I did the laundry and put them away, because my wife's a full-time kindergarten teacher, and she is dead to the world after that. So kids, yeah, and as an entrepreneur, I have the luxury of doing those certain things, but no, I don't know how to fold them right, and then it's crazy. Then we sort them, and then when do we get to put them away? As you see from your wife, it's a full-time job putting clothes away and doing laundry.
Oh, that is completely a full-time job. In fact, lately, because my oldest daughter is going to turn 6 this summer and my middle daughter turned 4, we've been kind of initiating this policy with them of them starting to put away their own clothes and making the initiative to do that. And they really kind of grasped it and enjoyed it. Of course, nothing is exactly where it's supposed to be, and which, you know, I can't find anything anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But they really kind of enjoyed it and embraced it. And so this is kind of a new step in our development process. And so far, so good.
So I can tell you there's a lot of interesting things. I wish we could talk longer, but again, everyone needs to pick up the book. So, Brian, where can we find information on you and also where our listeners can pick up the book?
Oh, great question. I've been writing a blog about parenting for a number of years called thelifeofdad.com. And on that site, you'll find a lot of free articles available. You know, you can find, you see examples of my writing, of different things that I'm doing. You can find links to buy the book. It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere books are sold. It actually was just released on Kindle. So if you love the e-readers, it's available for you there. And hopefully you can find all the information you want at thelifeofdad.com.
And also, you can purchase it at any major bookstore and check out all those places. I appreciate you calling, Brian. And I guess the parenting blog, a good idea. And what you need to do is put a link to the education shows, especially my parenting Q&A show. I don't know. Maybe you should be a guest on my Q&A show to answer questions from parents sometime, because you would give us a non-parenting expert, unless you are a parenting expert, and I missed that point, to give the answers to them from just firsthand experiences. So I appreciate you calling, Brian, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much, Neil. I appreciate you having me, and happy to be on anytime.
All right, take care, Brian. All right, you're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net. For more information, Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook. Well, I think that my wife was talking. I was on the phone with the healthcare people today, and I've been having a cough for 3 or 4 weeks, and now I'm finally going to go to a Minute Clinic to see what the deal is, because I think I have bronchitis, but I've been able to make it through thanks to having inhalers to be able to keep bringing broadcasting great radio. But I want to welcome the program author Matthew Spector, author of American Dream Machine. Matthew, thanks for calling.
Neil, thanks for having me.
So I don't sound like I have bronchitis, but we'll find out very soon after our interview what happens. But, hey, I always like to bring my personal life into my business. But, hey, that's what it is. So, Matthew, for the book American Dream Machine, basically tell us specifically your background that kind of leads to why you talked about this storyline.
I grew up in Los Angeles, and both my parents were in the film industry. My mother was a screenwriter, and my father still is a talent agent. And one of the things that the great myth that's around Los Angeles is that it's not a very hospitable place for writers. You know, people talk about, at least historically speaking, you know, people talk about Hollywood as a place that destroys writers. and at the same time, my experience of it was quite different. So I wanted to, you know, I had some interest in wanting to write a book about the movies, a book about the movie business. It doesn't satirize it or treat it with contempt, which I think a lot of representations of Hollywood tend to.
Very interesting. So growing up in this, you've seen the business, you know what the business is like, and it helps you understand and make this story up. So let's go for specifically the stories about two talent agents. And these two talent agents, basically, do they remind you of your family at all, the two talent agents?
Not in any direct way. It's interesting that the protagonist of the book, a man named Beau Rosenwald, is this sort of big, unkempt, ill-educated, not physically attractive, weirdly irresistible man who has this great, you know, magnetic effect on everybody he meets. And that, in many ways, my father is a sort of well-educated, charming, well-spoken, lovely man. So in some ways, I think you may have turned him inside out in order to invent this character.
Quite interesting. Yeah, I understand completely what you're talking about. So so the two talent agents have three troubled boys. And these troubled boys, in certain ways, I guess, fall into Hollywood's traps in a lot of ways. They live the life in certain aspects, right?
Yeah, I suppose they do. I mean, again, I feel that the story contends with two different generations. And I was interested in, you know, what are the effects of, you know, what happens when you have one generation that's very successful and then the next generation trying to contend with the fallout of that? That seems a problem that's not necessarily unique to Hollywood. You know, one sees the children of successful parents trying to you know, carve out their own path and reckon with some of the you know, complications that go with that. So I was interested in exploring that in the book for sure.
I think this is one of the issues a lot of times with successful people. And Matthew, successful people have something in their brain that's a little different, a lot different than most people wired in the world, that they have this drive. Sometimes this drive is a drive that's taking you away from everyone. It's just like almost like this is all I think about. I'm obsessed about it. So when children get put in this place, or another way where they're just very, very talented and could do things much better than other people, which a lot of agents can do. A lot of agents can BS their way through lots of things, be able to really work a room, find and make the right connections. Kids look at it like, oh, I can just do what my mom and dad did. And what happens is when they find out, then they have a letdown, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is sort of, it's a very, you know, kind of universal question. It's really about self-definition. You know, one of the things that the book that I, you know, struggled with the book, or really aspired towards with the book, was to make sure that, you know, even though this is a story set in Hollywood, it doesn't, you know, define itself or restrict itself to being a purely Hollywood story, you know, or a story about people with sort of high-end problems. You know, I think that question of, first of all, that question of self-definition from generation to generation is one that happens, you know, all over the world. It doesn't just happen in Los Angeles. But certainly in the case of this book, you know, the children are, you know, the children are the sons of this, you know, these two very, very magnetic, very, very complicated, you know, very, very emotionally sophisticated human beings, and they're needing to deal with the fallout from that, both, you know, in some ways that are quite positive. I mean, I think the kids wind up being pretty accomplished in their own right.
But at times that they rebel against what the family wanted in certain aspects, and so
don't we all?
Oh, I would you say did your dad want you to go in the same business he was in?
No, I don't think he did, actually. And my dad and I are really quite wonderfully close at this point, and there's something very lovely for me as an adult of being a person in the arts, and have my father as someone who's this, you know, tremendously vital 80-year-old man who guides people in the arts. You know, I've gotten old enough to be lucky to you know, harvest his advice. You know, but no, he did not particularly want me to go into the movie business. I can't imagine anybody who witnesses lives in the arts day in and day out would want that necessarily for their children.
You guys, we have a different brain. Matthew, I'll put myself as an artist as well. I mean, doing a radio show for free, just for fun, and syndicating it all over the world and spending hours on hours doing it, it's helped me make money in my entrepreneurial businesses, but yet you don't see it ultimately and then say, well, where's the paycheck in radio? Well, there's no paycheck in radio. It's just go out there and network and have fun talking to people. People are like, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to put hours on end. But when you're an artist and you just love your craft and love what you do, people that aren't artists don't understand.
Well, there's tremendous joy in it. I mean, there certainly was for me in writing this book, and there's no other real reason to, you know, I mean, one doesn't, you know, there are sort of ideas that one might achieve certain sorts of glory or sorts of success, but you know, that doesn't happen to most people in the arts. It doesn't happen to most people in Hollywood either.
No.
You know, and that's another kind of human aspect of the business that I wanted to explore. You know, this isn't really a book about fame. It's a book about human involvement in the arts and how the arts have changed in America in the last 50 years. How, you know, and I think they have gotten more difficult, you know, more corporatized, a little harder for the independent filmmaker, writer, for the individual person, really.
Well, I think this business has changed so much in the fact that before, you know, you were controlled by a union in certain aspects, not in a bad way, okay, but in a certain way. And when you're controlled in that type of an environment, things, what happens is you eliminate that, and a lot of people can work for a different price and work for a different thing. Everyone wants to be a star. So it changes the dichotomy of everything. It changes everything of the entire makeup of this business. And now you have a situation where you can make money on YouTube. You don't need any training at all. Or reality television, which kills the business altogether in some certain aspects. It's such a parallel to professional wrestling. Matthew, I don't know if your agent, your publicity agent, Julia, told you I was a former professional wrestler. And when I was doing it, independents got paid. They don't get paid anymore.
Yeah.
They don't pay independent wrestlers. Well, that's the difference.
Well, that's true. That's true in absolutely every walk of life. I mean, that's really what I was thinking about with this book. You know, I grew up in, when I was a kid, Hollywood was, you know, very much this, it was very much the Easy Riders, Raging Bulls era. There were, you know, you looked at the filmmakers were Hal Ashby and Robert Altman, and, you know, it was sort of a great time in American cinema, and it was very, very, you know, the personalities in it. And even when you look at the actors of that period, you know, you had good leading men like, you know, I don't know, Elliot Gould or, you know, Dustin Hoffman, these kind of people that did not, that did not seem the way that movie stars do today. They were sort of more strikingly individual presences. And I think, you know, we sort of lived through the 90s and the early 2000s, so, you know, and still in Hollywood we're sort of in that kind of tentpole blockbuster mentality where, you know, when movies used to be built, you know, from the bottom up, it used to be about, you know, an artist or an actor or a producer with an idea. And now it's, you know, movies are created by corporations with franchises. And I think things like, you know, YouTube and Kickstarter is sort of the way that the business is correcting itself a little bit. I mean, there's a kind of, you know, restoration of creative vitality to where it really belongs, which is, you know, with the individual imagination and people with ideas.
And also, let's look at the story about fathers and sons. That's the other thing you portray in American Dream Machine, is the fact that you have situations where a lot of times they don't get along in specific ways. They have different ideas. They're not really alike. And some people think fathers and sons are alike in so many ways, but yet there are fathers and sons, about father and son, that don't have the same agreements on anything, right?
Yeah, well, I think that's a very, very American story. And I mean, obviously, not just in writing this book, even outside this book, you know, I think about, you know, the way that we're magnetized to things like The Godfather, you know, and at its core, you know, The Godfather really is kind of a story about, you know, generations and fathers and children. You know, I think it's a core concern, and it's a core emotional concern, which is why I wanted to bring it into a book about Hollywood. I felt that, you know, most stories about the movie business aren't terribly emotional. They don't tend to explore the kind of human attachments that are at the center of that, as they are at the center of just about every part of, you know, of our lives.
Exactly. You hit it right there. That's the truth. And it's something that in a lot of ways people think, you know, I'm going to go into my father's business or I'm going to be going for the same major. But as we see the Gen Yers, Matthew, and the Gen Xers, they're kind of rebelling against that. And they're really, and I think that when you use the word American dream, the American dream is to choose something that you truly love and passionate and get paid for it. That is ultimately the difference. Not working for somebody else. Till we come up with that fact to understand that the American dream is entrepreneurship and doing things that we love, we're going to lose the fact of what it is. People think by just making money, we're going to be happy. And it's not true at all, Matthew.
No, it certainly isn't. And the book does kind of examine that. I mean, it examines the fact that, you know, all of us, we're wired to think that success will cure us of our problems. And, you know, I've certainly witnessed enough material success, enough of that sort of success, mostly in other people. I've witnessed it, but you know, it seems it often seems to have the opposite effect. You know, success is a complication as much as it is a fulfillment for people.
Exactly. The more busy you become, the more you don't even know about where you are, half the time, the more successful you become and the more the money you make, the more problems in certain aspects. So I guess always choosing, and I think the book will also say, always choosing something you love is more important than choosing something that might be more practical in certain ways, because you're going to look yourself in the mirror every day and say, what's going to make you passionate to get up each day and work hard?
For sure. I had an English friend, a playwright named Judge Butterworth, who once expressed astonishment to me that the pursuit of happiness was written into the Constitution. He found that idea extraordinary, that this was such a big part of the American identity, was that, you know, that it would actually be part of our governance. And at the same time, you know, it seems to me not just wise, but, you know, the idea that it's the pursuit of happiness.
Yes.